Thanks for listening to Shift Your Spirits. I'm Slade Robertson. For 12 years, I've been a professional intuitive and personal development blogger. I try to talk about spirituality with fewer hearts and flowers than most New Age blather. I also mentor emerging intuitives, psychics, and healers in a program called Automatic Intuition. It is Sunday, July 8th, 2018, as I record this introduction. In this week's episode, I have an interview with Ian Allen about Appalachian witchery. For months, I've wanted to have someone on the show to talk about magic and the craft, so I'm really excited to share this conversation with you. That's coming up in just a few minutes. As always, there's an Oracle segment at the end of the show, so be thinking about a question or a concern you have. Hold it in your mind, and I'll come back on after the final links and credits and leave you with that extra channeled message. I'm going to keep the personal news short so you can spend the time listening to a longer interview segment. This week, I have been going to bed every night and waking up every morning with at least part of my mind on the boys trapped in the cave in Thailand. As I record this, I have the TV on mute across the office as they're beginning to be rescued. At this point, there are 4 or 5 through the caves and at the hospital. I'm hoping by the time you're listening to this, we've heard that everyone is accounted for, safe, and physically okay. I do want to mention that one of my friends from my early 20s took his own life this week. It was devastating to hear that Rob is no longer with us. He was part of a large circle of friends, artists, and musicians living in the Cabbage Town neighborhood of Atlanta in the early 1990s. Wanting to send more than just thoughts and prayers to his sister, I wrote and told her the truth, that I'm reminiscing about those days and how much she and her brother are part of an enormous chosen family and always will be. So if anyone from that era and that community happens to be listening, or if Wynn hears this herself, I'm thinking of you all in a way that I haven't in a long time and overwhelmed by how much happiness there is in those memories. Before I forget, I've uploaded a new bonus episode for Patreon supporters on cord cutting, and I want to say a quick thank you to my newest supporter, Rebecca Diamond. I appreciate all of you who've pledged your support, and I'm really excited to see the new names each week. It demonstrates that you're enjoying the show and want it to continue. That's very encouraging to me, so thank you. Listeners who support the show on Patreon can access a guided meditation called Messages from Your Spirit Guides, exclusive bonus episodes, and there's also a mastery level of support where you can download one of my courses for free each month. By request, I've added a few more mid-range levels of support, so check those out. The bonus episodes are available to everyone who pledges $3 or more. To find out how you can become a patron, support my time in producing this show, and access all the extra bonus content, please go to patreon.com/shiftyourspirits. So let's get into the interview. Ian Allen is a psychic and intuitive witch living in Johnson City, Tennessee. He owns and operates Appalachian Witchery, where he teaches classes on Appalachian folklore and magic. He offers tarot and psychic readings, as well as magical consultations and spell creation. I think this is a really cool conversation. I hope you guys enjoy it. Let's listen to Ian.
Okay. My name is Ian Allen. I live in Johnson City, Tennessee. Was originally raised in a small coal mining town in Southwest Virginia. Not West Virginia, but Virginia in the southwest corner, called Wise, and grew up kind of a traditional Appalachian family, but became more knowledgeable, I guess would be the word I would use, about dreams that I was having and feelings I would be getting about people I would meet at churches or in public atmospheres that would start becoming true. And so I became pretty obsessed with occult sort of ideas from a very young age. And it just kind of started developing from there. Around the age 13 is probably when I really started working on developing certain gifts or abilities, if you want to use that word. And it just kind of went on from there. I became a public tarot reader and witch about 11 years ago. I've been doing all of that for over 20 years at this point now, but really stepped into the public sphere about 11 years ago and started reading for the public and offering classes on different topics relating to witchcraft, as well as specifically Appalachian folk magic.
Okay, so I'm just curious, when you meet someone for the first time in real life and they ask you what you do, what do you say?
Well, previous to March, I would really much say I teach Appalachian folklore and magic. I also read tarot cards. It's not something I've ever really been shy about telling people.
Okay.
I just last October had an interview with the local newspaper and my pictures in it, and it's titled Appalachian Witchery. So if people have read the paper, they saw my face, they read an article about me. It's not something I've ever really hidden. It does obviously get a lot of weird looks or eye rolls sometimes, but that just kind of comes with the with that whole idea of being a witch. People don't want to think that we exist sometimes, or that we're just crazy people. So it's something I've gotten used to. I've gotten a thicker skin over the years.
One of the reasons I asked that question, and I've started asking it of a lot of the people that I interview, is because so many of the people who listen to this show and the people that I work with in particular are in some kind of process of sort of coming out of the broom closet or coming out of the psychic closet, coming out of some kind of closet, right? So it's helpful to hear other people's stories and also hear sometimes that we don't all just walk around, like carrying a sign,
Oh, yeah.
there's a very varied nuances to how we answer that question and how we, go about in the public. And you've been confronted with the very real reality of having the local newspaper feature you, whereas I'm kind of anonymous locally, but yet more globally visible. You know what I mean? So it must be a little bit different being like, but you're the town witch, everybody's got to have one, right?
Exactly. Historically, yeah, every village had a witch or someone who could do herbalism, who would also do magic on the side. So yeah, every village, every town usually had someone that they would go to, and I'm okay with being that. There, and I'm not the only one here in Johnson City. Believe me, there are plenty of witches here. I guess I am probably one of the more outspoken ones, who hasn't hid himself away, or herself away. And so with that, does come a certain lack of anonymity within the public locally. And I'm okay with that. I like taking care of my community. People who you wouldn't suspect have come to me for readings, for discussion of spell creation and that sort of thing. People who are, ministers' wives, ministers themselves. But that stays kind of like, I always view it as a almost like a psychologist sort of thing, where if you come to me, you come to me, and it doesn't leave this room. No one's going to know your name. No one's going to know what we talked about. And so I think that that's definitely helped, word of mouth, I guess, for my business, if you want to look at it that way. But it's more of a, I like taking care of my local community. Not that I don't care about my global community at all. I do care about them, but I growing up in the in the 90s, there was that whole think locally or think globally, act locally adage. And so I've always kind of tried to live by that adage. If I can affect my small town in some way, then they'll start affecting the world at a larger rate than I could by myself.
Well, listen, there are people who listen to this show from all over the world. I mean, Australia, Singapore. I have a lot of fans in Singapore for some reason. Hey, guys. Europe, you know, places where, you know, even maybe there's some people in Canada who don't really know about the Appalachian region and culture that we're talking about. You are from a city called Johnson City, which is in northeast Tennessee, kind of in the corner with North Carolina and Virginia. So if you would just kind of explain for everybody a little bit about what Appalachian magic and folklore is, as you know, how you would sum it up.
Okay. Well, the first thing that I always do in my classes is discuss the word that you're pronouncing. You're saying Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
I pronounce it Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that. There's kind of an imaginary line, like the Mason-Dixon line, sort of, about the pronunciation of the word of the mountains that we live in. And below this imaginary line, so probably somewhere below Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia sort of area, you're going to hear it pronounced Appalachia. Above that, they're going to say Appalachia. And part of that is, you know, it's just dialect. But it was a way for people back in the 1800s into the early 1900s to know who was an outsider and who could be trusted. Because the carpetbaggers who would come down into the south, into the Appalachian Mountains, or the coal miners or the coal companies who would send in people from the north, they would say Appalachia. And we learned they weren't fully to be trusted because they were exploiting us. They were stealing our land. They were stealing our property, stealing our coal, taking our trees, and then leaving us in poverty. And so words, first off, have a lot of power. They have a lot of meaning. So when, and it's not wrong to say Appalachia, because the people in the Appalachian Mountains into Pennsylvania and Vermont and Maine, they do pronounce it Appalachia. So their pronunciation is right for them. But when you're talking Southern Appalachia, it's more proper to use that pronunciation of Appalachia.
So I sound like a carpetbagger. What the hell? I'm from Tennessee. Actually, you know what would be funny is if I wasn't looking at that word written down and I was surrounded by my family, because my dialect changes depending on who I'm speaking with, I wonder which way I would say it if I wasn't thinking about it. I'm going to be listening for it now in every in like how my family says it. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt, but go ahead.
No, that's perfectly fine. Because what you just talked about is like, if you were hanging out with your family, how would you say it? That's what we call code switching. We all have different ways of talking and different words that we use depending on who we're talking to and what events going on. There's a great book by a great professor of mine who I from the University of Virginia's College at Wise. Her name's Amy Clark. She wrote, or she edited, a book called Talking Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And it's a book of collected essays about, or from people from around the Appalachian region who wrote about code switching, basically, and how they talked and why they talked the way they did. It's a fascinating thing if you're into linguistics.
I was a linguistics major originally in college. Yes, I am interested in that.
Yeah, so that's a good thing. And I've totally rambled off of your first question. Your question was more about Appalachian magic and folklore, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people, so we've identified a little bit of the area physically, geographically that we're talking about. So why don't you tell us where the magic part comes from, or maybe what's unique about Appalachian magic? Like, where did this fusion of stuff come from?
Okay, so Appalachian folk magic is really kind of a conglomeration of Scot beliefs, Irish beliefs, English beliefs, German, and a little bit of Cherokee practices, as within this area, because it was pretty isolated. And even to this day, they consider the Appalachians isolated from the rest of the larger United States, but these groups of people started settling here in these mountains, and they would share some of their beliefs with one another, and they kind of just created a mixing pot, a nice mix in a cauldron, if you want to keep doing the witch stuff, of beliefs and culture, and created something that was more unique. I think it's probably the most American of practices, because I mean, you do have folk magic in New England, but it was very much colonial English sort of practices that they continued because that was who settled there. In the mountains, you had more people who came from sort of the lower echelons of society, so to speak, come into the mountains because they said, oh, no one settled here. There's plenty of land. Let's move here and create our own wealth. Not realizing how rocky and sandy the mountains were and not really fit for a lot of farming. But so then their life, the hardscrabble life, created different myths, different practices, different folklores. Things like the Wampus Cat are definitely Appalachian in origin. So that's sort of how all of this kind of came about, was different people from different but similar backgrounds coming together to live and then just having to share with one another because of how isolated the area actually was at the time.
Okay. So you mentioned the Wampus Cat. What are some of the topics that you teach classes about when you teach Appalachian folklore? Just kind of tell us, what are some of the topics?
So the first one that I always like to teach, and I usually teach it maybe twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall, is just kind of an introduction to Appalachian folklore and magic. And that just covers a broad series of topics, such as who settled the area, where do we get it, some folk remedies. I discuss some of the legends, like the Wampus Cat, or as he's now become named, the Wood Booger, which is not the most flattering of a name for a creature in Appalachia, but, you know, whatever. Call it whatever you want. It's a big hairy man, kind of like a Bigfoot running around in our woods. And then we talk about divination techniques. And then some of the other classes. I do a class just on divination techniques that are unique here to this area, which, of course, are also similar to other things that people do in the broader world, like dowsing. Is a big thing within the mountains, especially what they call water witching. That's, you know, where a person who has a special ability to find water would take a specific type of wood, and the wood varied depending on the family. My grandfather used peach tree wood to douse for water to dig a well. Whereas other families have, I know they use ash or even elder to douse with. But then, of course, water witching has been done all over the world, and also pendulum, using things like a wedding band on the woman's, taking a piece of hair from the woman's head and dangling her wedding band over her pregnant belly would indicate, you know, male or female. And so I teach a class on just specifically Appalachian techniques. I also teach classes on how to read playing cards as a divination tool and tarot cards. I teach some modern witchcraft classes.
Let me take you back into the past a little bit and come back up to where your knowledge is now. But so for a long time, I've really been wanting to talk to someone on this show about witchcraft and magic, because I come to all of this New Age stuff from an identification as a witch at a really young age. And So my family is very much Appalachian, and I've got some Appalachian witchery, you know, a few, you know, steps back, like grandparents, you know. But I very much grew up in suburbia. So for the most part, I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. So, you know, a decent sized city, suburbia. So my identification as a witch, I have to tell you this story because I haven't told it to other people, but I was probably about 8 or 9 years old because I actually looked it up to see when the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours came out, because that was
Oh,
ni
yeah.
1977. I loved that album. And I remember it must have been soon after that, because my family was going on a car trip somewhere, like maybe to Florida or something long like that. And so I think my mom had told me that I could buy a magazine at the grocery store. And so I got her to buy me a Rolling Stone magazine, which she was kind of like, why do you want a Rolling Stone magazine? You know, you're 8. But it was because there was a feature on Stevie Nicks. And in that magazine, I got it because it was just her, and it was like cool pictures of her, and I was like, oh, Stevie, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in the back of the car, you know, driving through Georgia, 1970 something, and I'm reading Stevie Nicks talking about white witchcraft and how, you know, she's a white witch and all this stuff. And I had this total epiphany of like, oh my God, I'm a white witch. That's what I am, you know? So from that point on, I was always interested in Wicca, you know, as a teenager. And in college, I kind of discovered I did a women's studies certificate in college just because it was like you could take these more interesting, cool kind of classes that were, you know, feminist, but they were within different things, like, you know, some kind of feminist history or, you know, something like that. And after you took so many of them, they actually would give you a certificate in women's studies. And sometimes I was the only guy in these classes, but I just liked the topics. I would see the syllabus or the, you know, class listed in the roster, and I'd be like, oh, that sounds amazing. So anyway, I got turned on through this Irish women's studies teacher of mine to all this like really modern feminist paganism, right? So I was reading, one of my favorite books is, there's an NPR reporter named Margot Adler who wrote a book called Drawing Down the Moon. And it's kind of a collection of all the various different types of modern witchcraft in America or modern neo-paganism. And then probably the big one for me, a big game changer, was The Spiral Dance by Starhawk. And that was when I kind of connected the whole feminine principle of the goddess, you know, like the life force in the universe is being a feminine thing, which was instinctively true for me, and she kind of made that like intellectual connection for me in a way. So anyway, I'm wondering, like, what is your version of that? Like, what were your, how did you come to this? Were there other people in your family, or did you just, you know, were you encouraged, discouraged? What was your story of how you sort of discovered this part of yourself?
Oh yeah. I guess the easiest way to explain that, I have to go back to the 80s, when I was first, because I was only born in 83, so it was a weird time being born in 83, or the late 80s in the area of the Appalachians that I grew up in. Because I grew up, like I said, in a town called Wise, Virginia, and that is on the very tail end of Virginia. It's about 20 minutes drive to Kentucky, and coal had started to kind of fail. It was no longer king in the area, and so people were starting to lose jobs, mines were closing down, and the world there was trying to figure out what to do next. Sadly, they still haven't figured it out. But that's a whole other podcast, I guess,
Yeah,
to talk
right.
about the devastation of coal companies on the people within Appalachia. But so that area was very stuck trying to figure out how do we move into a sort of modern mindset, when we don't want to. We still want to be very old-fashioned, very traditional in our community. And I kind of got swept up in that as I was, you know, coming of age, thinking there's nothing here for me, watching MTV and thinking, oh, I'm going to be on Real World or Road Rules, and that's how I'm going to see the world. Trying to get away from it, but very deeply still wanting to connect with where I was being born. And the word witch was never used in my family as far as like describing my aunts or my great aunts or my great uncles or any of that, because they were very Christian. And that's something I also try to stress in my classes is I use the word witch because I think it's the most apt word and witchcraft as the most apt word for describing the practices that people did here. But they were very staunchly Christian. And so everything they did came through the power of prayer to Jesus or to God. They weren't real hip on the Catholics either.
Right.
yeah, there are many a sermon I sit through connecting Catholicism basically to Satanism. So they, growing up, they weren't real hip on Catholics, even though my dad is from, well, he's an army brat, but his family ended up settling in the Fairfax area, and they are Catholic. So half of my family is Catholic, and the other half is very traditional Southern and Free Will Baptist in the mountains. But everyone in my family still did things. They would interpret dreams. They would talk about ghost stories. The professor I mentioned earlier, Amy Clark, in her English composition class, I think it was Composition 102, she made us do an oral history report. And I went and interviewed my great aunt Fern and collected all sorts of folklore and stories about the road I grew up on, because growing up, it was mostly all my family that lived on this road. And she shared a story about how my my mamaw, or grandmother, if people don't know what the word mamaw is, my mamaw and her cousin Ione used to go stay with the lady out on this other back road called Red Wine, and everyone thought she was a witch. She could move, like, things would move in her house without her touching them. And my Aunt Fern didn't really know a whole lot because she was never invited to go sleep over there. So she only heard, like, secondhand stories. But there were definitely stories growing up that I would hear. And then there were also the little remedies that my mama would make or other people in the family would make for people being sick. But I started having dreams from a very young age where I was like, oh, this is actually real. This is happening. And they were more literal dreams. They weren't the ones that I would have to go interpret like, oh, there are three cows in my dreams. What does that mean? It was like, oh, I'm walking into church and here's someone that hasn't been in church in a while sitting there. And they're getting ready to give a testimony about how they've been sick. And then that Sunday we'd go to church and that would happen. And I was like, oh, well, this is interesting. And I also just really loved stories about witches, about vampires, about the monsters. That was where my interest as a very young child was at. Like I specifically remember in second grade, my best friend Ashley had wore her mother's winter cloak to school, and we went to library, and I took her cloak and put it on like a cape and was running around like I was a vampire. I very specifically remember that because I got in trouble for that because it was a library and I was not supposed to be running around having all this fun. But while everyone else was there checking out the Hardy Boys books, I was in the weird section checking out the children's versions of Frankenstein or Dracula and those sorts of books. And so I would try to watch anything on TV that, you know, my mother would allow me to watch about witchcraft or whatever. And I became, obsessed is probably the best word for it. Kind of became obsessed with it, especially like the Salem witch trials. And I, Halloween is still my favorite holiday to this day. And so I always look forward to the fall, and specifically October, because then, when Discovery Channel and the History Channel were actually about science and history, and they would show specials about the history of witchcraft or the history of vampires, and I would, even if they repeated the same thing 10 times that month, I would watch it every time it came on. And then when I was 13, we took a trip to, it was a whole big family trip. We drove with the entire family, some uncles, some aunts, up to Gettysburg to see the reenactment, probably on the 4th of July, around the 4th of July, because I think that's when they do all their big reenactments. But so we went there, and then we were following my mom's brother on up to Connecticut, where him and his wife had moved to. And I realized that Connecticut was very close to Massachusetts, and I convinced my family to take a day trip to Salem. And so one day we all piled in the car and drove, I think, like the 5 or 6 hours to Salem. And I was like, I guess awestruck is probably the best word for it, because I was like, wow, they're talking about witchcraft like it's something that anyone can do. That it's actually real and tangible. And I remember seeing this woman walking down the street in long black robes with her staff and black hair flowing. And then I discovered who that was. And it's a woman named Laurie Cabot, who's been titled the official witch of Salem. And I was like, wow, witches are real. And I bought my first deck of tarot cards when I was there. And then we came home, and I just started reading tarot cards with the little white book that came with it for friends and family. And that slowly started to develop more and more. And then I purchased a couple of books on Wicca and witchcraft, one being Laurie Cabot's book, Power of the Witch, and then a book by Scott Cunningham. I think it was Wicca, A Guide for a Solitary Practitioner. And then I discovered, oh, there's a shop in Kingsport called Dilly's Curiosity Shop. And they had books and herbs and candles. And it wasn't just a witch shop, they had tons of stuff on the New Age movement, on Hinduism. It was just kind of a hippie New Age sort of store. And I, once I became old enough to drive, would usually you could usually find me there every weekend or every other weekend, spending my hard saved allowance on books and candles and things that I needed. And so it really started from there, was when I discovered, oh wow. So about 13, like, wow, witchcraft is real, and this is what my family's been doing, and this is what I've been doing naturally for years. And so starting to study it from there just kind of helped develop it more into something that wasn't just an occasional, oh, I'm having a dream, or I'm getting a sensation from meeting this person, or I feel like I need to leave some food outside for whatever's going to be creeping around outside to protect the house. That sort of thing. It wasn't just something that I did spontaneously anymore. It became more of a honed practice.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, actually, let's see. I'm going to come back to that and ask you a little bit about your personal practice, but I'm interested in first of all those books were like taking me back. I used to work in one of those stores like you're talking about. It was called the New Moon, and I basically would like was like the person who chose the books for the magic section. Like all the people who worked there, we all had our different kind of area of expertise. There was somebody who did all the crystals and stones. There was a guy who was a druid and he did all of that. There was a guy who was into Buddhism, and so all that section of the store, he would sort of advise the owner what to buy. And my thing was goddess spirituality, Wicca, this whole thing. So the books that you're naming off, I'm like, oh yeah, we had that book, we had that book. So I'm interested, when I was talking about Starhawk always defined magic, which she took from someone named Dion Fortune, as the art of changing consciousness at will. And so I kind of wonder, what's your definition of magic? Like, what is that to you? How does it work?
It's a question that, most people want to know a definition to. And as I said, I've studied and practiced for 20 some years, so I've read all those definitions, Dionne Virtue, Starhawk, Aleister Crowley. And I think, yes, they're all pretty accurate. The art of changing consciousness that will. I like to kind of take it a little step further, and it's more than just changing your consciousness. It's also because changing your consciousness is one thing, but being able to change physical reality is a whole other. And I know as you get deeper into the magic conversations and topics, we talk about micro and macrocosms, and how if you change your consciousness, then you are changing physical reality. But being able to literally change your physical reality is part of my definition of magic. So it would be more like the art of changing physical reality and your consciousness at will, in alignment with natural forces. Because I don't believe that there's anything really supernatural about anything that witches do. We are using natural energies and natural forces. We're just using it in a way that most people aren't aware of the ability and how to manipulate those energies to affect the change we want to see.
She goes on in her definition. She talks about the art part is using sensory imagery and symbols that evoke emotions, and then the will is kind of directed energy and intention, and together those things sort of, mix and shift because we're kind of swimming around in this emotional thought energy, soup or whatever. So, what's interesting to me, see, is that sounds like people talking about law of attraction and talking about manifesting. And I started blogging 12 or 13 years ago, and I guess the vocabulary that was popularized by The Secret sort of eclipsed some of what we call magic. It was like no longer fashionable to use the word magic. Now it's manifesting. Do you have any observations about the relationship between those things? Is that something that you notice as well?
I definitely believe that there is validity in the law of attraction, in its relation to magic. I am definitely not going to be your love and light person, when it comes to this conversation, because I think most of what we get with law of attraction is bullshit for the most part. When it comes down to you have cancer because you wanted cancer. You wanted to be sick. I think it especially I don't want to name names because I don't want to, start any internet wars with anyone, but there are certain people who purport this law of attraction, and about being in alignment with it, and or stepping out of it, and you have to step out of it to know when you're in alignment with your law of attraction. And it's very victim blaming to me, the way that they discuss it sometimes. And it's not helpful and it's not beneficial, for the people who are in crisis mode, because then they think, oh, well, I did this to myself. And yes, there is a part of it that I believe that we do to ourselves. We make choices, we make whether they're subconscious or conscious choices, we make them that create our realities. I mean, that's true. If I choose not to do something, I'm going to have the consequences of that action. But the manifestation of magic is definitely you do certain things to attract what you're trying to get in your life. If I'm trying to get a job, you know, I'm going to put my energy into my resume of attracting the job I want. And as a witch, I will take it a step further and use, like, I might anoint the edge of the page, the edge of my resume with an oil blend I've made to attract a good job for me, or the best job for my highest good. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do that and then send the resume in. I guess now most things are electronic. I know some witches who electronically they have like it's on the back of paper that you put on a watermark. A very faint watermark of a sigil that they created. And a sigil, you know, it's just an image that you create and you imbue with a certain energy. Mm-hmm. So they would create like a job sigil and put that onto the back of their resume before they emailed it out. And so for me, that's more of how the law of attraction works. It kind of goes back to the idea that I grew up with being raised in a Christian home, but a magical Christian home. You know, God helps those who help themselves. So if you're acting in alignment with something that you want, then the universe is going to provide that. But you have to do it in the accurate way. And so for me, I don't like using the term law of attraction just because of all of that baggage that I feel comes with it. Mm-hmm. And how simplified things like The Secret made it. It's not just, ooh, I'm going to sit in my house and make a pretty dream board and hang it up and it's going to manifest. At least in my experience, it's been, you can do that, but if you don't put in the work to try to manifest it, the universe isn't going to give it to you. Mm-hmm. So I think the law of attraction has been simplified, and that it has, because the New Age movement has a lot of money behind it, especially when you're being published by people like HarperCollins or the bigger publishing companies, they can definitely get you more exposure than like Llewellyn could get you. I don't think you'll see many Llewellyn books on the bestsellers list the way that you will, you know, Penguin or HarperCollins, those sorts of publishing companies.
Sure.
And so it definitely, if it's going to feed the capitalist society, then they're going to pounce on it. Yeah, I guess that's my answer for your question on law of attraction.
No, that's cool. I'm very happy to hear your take on all that, because it does. I think it always sort of I feel the contrast in it, and I'm always aware kind of the intersection of that terminology. So I'm one of those people who I use other people's vocabulary in order to reach them, like you were saying. You know, for instance, there are a lot of really Christian people who use Christian vocabulary to talk about magic. So if I'm going to talk about magic to them, I'm going to use their vocabulary, because otherwise you shut them down if you start coming at them with, you know, like calling it the goddess. You know, if you're talking to a 90-year-old woman about, you know, folklore, and she's talking about Jesus, just call it Jesus. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
Just keep on going. Yeah. So to me, it's always a language thing. It was interesting, your whole thing about the word Appalachia. I did not know that specifically, but so that was like a huge epiphany for me to hear that about the idea of how it identifies someone, you know, from being somewhere else. So I was a linguistics major, and I'm always interested in language. And to me, as a writer, magic and spellcrafting is very much sort of rooted in a lot of language. And when I do assessments of my mentoring students, I actually listen for the way in which they speak about these things. And that doesn't mean the obvious stuff like the symbolism and the archetypes and the buzzwords. I actually am listening for the actual words that they use? Like, are they using passive language? Are they using a lot of visual language? Are they, you know, do they speak emotionally? You know, those kinds of things sometimes tell you a lot. You know, it's subtext.
Yes.
To, you know, to shorten the story. So I'm interested, you touched on a couple things, like the whole thing about the resume was interesting. What other kind of, not the things that you necessarily do for your clients or that you teach, but just in your own personal life, like what kind of rituals do you observe, or what kinds of magic do you do, like everyday kind of household magic?
Okay. Yeah. So household magic, that's always been kind of a big part of most folk magics. I always like using folk magic instead of calling it low magic, mm-hmm. because it makes it seem like it's something less worthy. Because by definition, high magic is like super occulty sort of things where you have to have a special robe and special pentagrams painted on the floor. And then I don't know who popularized the terms high and low magic, but low magic was what the common folk did. And you know what? I'm a common folk. I like being a common folk. I don't want all the responsibility of being John Dee and deciphering things for Queen Elizabeth. That's not my interest area. I don't want to go and sit in the White House, especially this White House, and you know, manifest messages for any political figure, especially what we have now. But so my daily practice, this is something that people from almost all backgrounds, culturally, they have, if they dig deep enough, is ancestor veneration. Ancestors play a big part in my practice and in the practice of the Appalachian people, as well as other cultures as well. I'm not forgetting them. It's big in hoodoo and voodoo as well, in African American and African traditions. But it's also big in European traditions. And so I definitely try to make sure I light a candle on my ancestor altar every day and just kind of say hello to them. Let them know that I'm still thinking of them and, you know, thanks for being who you were, because then I couldn't be who I am if it wasn't for you. And that's not to say that all my ancestors were great people, because they weren't. We all have those rotten branches and the rotten fruit on our family trees. And so in classes, I do teach ways to kind of, you know, you don't want to invite all of your entire ancestry into your home, because you might have a child molester or murderer or, you know, serial rapist in your family. And that's definitely not what you want to invite into your home. And so I teach ways to kind of, you know, try to hopefully help them along on the other side to get to where they need to be. But in my practice, you know, I try to light a candle for them every day and just say thank you, because sometimes my magic is just me going to the altar and saying, I really need your all's help. This is a situation. And I'll bring them food. I'll cook them a special meal of whatever it is that they specifically like. Usually it's cornbread. It's something very Southern. Cornbread, soup, beans, pork chops, really salty country ham that I can't stand to eat because it's too salty. But but I will set it on their altar and light the candles and kind of say a prayer to them. It's sort of like the idea of Catholics asking saints for help. That's how a lot of witches use ancestors. And sometimes that's all you need to do to get help. You might get answers in your dreams from from one of your ancestors. And it might be even someone that you don't know is your ancestor. So a random person will pop up in your dream and give you the answer. Or things just start magically happening in your life. Like, I was really needing help to get this job, and then suddenly you get 4 job offers. That sort of thing. I try to bless my food before I eat it. I do a lot of garden work, and so I definitely try to take care of the plant spirits. In my belief structure, I'm what you would consider an animist. So I definitely believe that every plant has its own very specific spirit. The dirt has its own spirit. So I try to get to know that spirit, talk to it, learn about it. I am the crazy person in my condos that's seen outside mumbling to themselves. And I think that's where, I think that's kind of where the idea of witches, you know, muttering to themselves came from, is that we talked to everything, things that no one else would see. We would be talking to the trees, to the plants, to the birds that were up in the trees, and also muttering spells under our breath, usually for the good. Not all witches do things for the good of all. So, I mean, that's usually my general practice. I don't do like a daily spell. I'm not, mostly because my life doesn't dictate that I need it. My life isn't that hectic that I'm like, I have to put it back together. Right. Always. But I do like magically craft things. I make what's now commonly referred to as books of shadows, you know, spell books. I tea stain pages. With special herbs for special meanings of like keeping secrets and keeping power in the book. And I bind them and add in special pictures. And, you know, I try to sell them. Sometimes I just give them as gifts. I do magical crafts pretty much on the regular, making like witch's cords, which is just kind of a braided cord with special items like oak leaves or tarot cards, feathers. And generally I have a very specific purpose in mind for each of them. Like I will make one for protection of the house, one to get a job, one to be enchanting, to have enchantments over people to make yourself kind of like a glamour, make yourself look more appealing. And you just really kind of hang these in your home or your office, for whatever purpose it is that you, I would create it for you. And just looking at it, kind of helps imbue you with that energy, because all the energy is there and it kind of just drips down like a rain cord. And so, I mean, that's pretty much basically my, my daily practice. I'm not a, like I said, I don't do spells every day, just because my life doesn't dictate it, that I need to do a spell every day, but I do sit in communication with the spirit world almost every day. Whether that's plant spirits or my ancestor spirits or both.
Well, I guess you are like me, and you're a like-minded soul in that you want this to be normal and part of your everyday life. Like, it doesn't have to be some high ritual. Like, there's something almost off-putting about that to me, whereas something that I can incorporate into my daily existence. I'm a big sweeper. Like, I sweep a lot. And, you know, I, like you were talking about, that's where the image of witches, like outside, you know, crazy people muttering spells to themselves. I'm outside, like, sweeping all the time. Like, I'm that weird little old person who's like, you know, I'm practicing for like when I'm a little old man out there sweeping the sidewalk. But, so you talked a little bit about these magical crafts. Now, how does that play into, you do professional magical consultations and you create spells for people? So is there something similar in what you do for your clients?
Definitely. And just to get back to the brooms, I'm obsessed with brooms. I have, I don't know how many brooms I have hanging in the house, but I love brooms. I love the magic of sweeping. Like I have a specific broom for sweeping off my front walk. And then I have a specific broom that I use if I go to a client's house to clean out energy or angry ghost or that sort of thing, that I only use for that specific purpose. But so, you know, magical consultations, might involve my broom, depending on what they come to me for. So a client will, you know, usually contact me on my Facebook page, or the, my number is on my Facebook page too, or they'll call me. And then we'll set up an appointment time. And sometimes I know beforehand, because they want to share a little bit over the phone about, this is why I need to come meet you. I'm having a hard time, in my marriage, or I'm having a hard time finding a job. And in the meeting, I take a lot of notes. I know that's off-putting for some clients. Like, why are you writing this down? Like, I write it down because while I will remember most things, I don't remember everything when I go back home and start creating a spell or a ritual for the person. And so they'll bring me their issue or their troubles, or what they're trying to magically create in their life. And the consultation usually involves a reading of some sort. I will get my cards out and see if there's some, if there is a block to what they're trying to do, because sometimes we do create blocks for ourselves, or there are people in our life that are blocks. Like if you're trying to save your marriage, but your partner is not wanting to save your marriage, they are completely over that marriage. You don't want to, you know, try to force a marriage with someone who's really trying to escape that. And so it's important for me to do these readings when I'm doing consultations, because I don't want to trap someone into a marriage that it will eventually make both people completely miserable. Or the job that they're trying to get, we will look at that specific job and kind of look at the future and be like, oh, you will be happy here. So, you know, I'll craft something to help you be more enchanting in your interviews, or just draw the energy to you specifically for this job. Or if it's the other way, this job is going to be a terrible fit for you. You'll like it for a bit, but then it's going to be super draining. I would do something more like a road opener, so to speak, to make them more open to more offers of job, to a bigger spectrum of jobs, where they might need to take that job initially, but continuing to be open and going out and trying to attract the job that's going to be most beneficial for them. And so I will sit down and talk with the person, do a reading, and then I usually try to bring so many different herbs and things with me, so I can create little baths that the person can take if they need to have, like, a cleansing bath or a bath to make them have more self-esteem, that sort of thing. I can create that on the spot and give it to them. But if it's something that requires more work, like if I have to go purchase certain items that I don't have on hand, then we set up another time to meet, if it's something that I need them to do. Because for me, magic is most potent if the person that needs the magic is involved in it in some physical way. Whereas if I'm just at my house doing a spell for you, say, I'm not going to have as much emotion in it as you are going to be able to manifest for yourself, because it's affecting you more than it is me. I can pull up as much emotion as I possibly can, and I do, and I send it out. And, not every spell is going to work. It's kind of a 70-80% chance that it's going to manifest the way you want it to. Because I'm a big advocate when I talk about magic, is magic is going to take the path of least resistance. So you need to be specific and general at the same time in what you're trying to manifest. And I know that sounds like a contradiction to be general and specific, but if you're just, oh, I need money, and we do a money spell, you know, you might get an inheritance, but your mother might die. And that's not what you're trying to manifest. You want money, but what do you want that money for? So you want that money because you want to go on a vacation. So let's do a spell for that vacation instead of just money.
Interesting. Yes.
And that's where the consultation comes in handy, instead of just someone sending me a message saying, hey, I need a spell for this, and me sitting down, okay, cool, I'll just write you the spell, and I'll send you all the stuff and all the instructions, and you do it, because it might manifest in a way that they aren't expecting or wanting. And that's why I take so many notes, getting down to the nitty gritty, exactly what the person is trying to create in their life, dictates exactly what type of spell, or magical ritual, if I feel it needs to get to that point, would dictate.
Is this something that you always have to do in person, or can you do it over the phone and send people things?
I can do it over the phone, and then mail the stuff out. sometimes there are things that I will do on my end, and then I'll just send pictures of my work as I'm going along, so they know I'm actually doing it.
Right.
instead of, because there are crooks out there who are like, I will do a spell for you. Send me $400.
Right.
And then they sit at home and eat popcorn and watch Netflix, and then send you a message. I've done it. You should see it happening.
Right.
I try to keep things on the up and up as much as possible. So I will send people pictures as much as I can. I do think sometimes taking pictures and documenting it can sometimes zap a bit of the energy out of it. But that's my own personal belief. Kind of going back to the idea of electronics pulling energy, but.
Well, I think that, the one thing that, electronics does do is it allows us to reach people that aren't here. Like, it takes away the distance somewhat so that you can, speak to somebody that's on the other side of the country. But I would think that, the fact that there is this sort of physical object that you often create, like the cords or, a little grimoire or something like that. There's something, the reason I could never be a Buddhist is because I like attaching energy and emotion to things. I find objects that have been imbued with power and emotion and association and intention to be extremely delicious. And I want them sitting around on my shelves and stuff, So I think that's one of the ways in which, magic really differs. But I would think that there would be something to that sort of crafted item that is uniquely special to the way that you do readings and healings. In working with people who do different kinds of readings or healings or whatever, I usually talk to them about the idea that there's a diagnostic part of their session and then there's a healing active part of their session. For me, it's all language. It's all words. Like it's basically I'm an enabler and I can give you a big pep talk. And that is the way that I heal. For other people, it might be something like, doing Reiki, or like you said, it might be going and clearing spirits, or it might be crafting this item, this spell. And then you use the intuitive part as a kind of diagnosis, like what's really going on here before I go messing with it, what's underneath the layers. So I think that your practice is really kind of cool and unique. And the reason why I asked about if you could do it at a distance is because I know that there are a lot of people listening who are going to want you to now and going to contact you and say, wait a minute, can you do this over the phone? Because I really want one. Before we talk about how people could get in touch with you, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions. One is, are we doing okay on time for you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. I'm loving this conversation. I could talk to you all day. You could come back once a month. So what do you kind of most hope to contribute to the sort of greater conversation about spirituality and New Age stuff? You touched on the idea that, of course, being published by a major publisher can sometimes falsely, put those ideas forward. I'm a very much a proud indie author, podcaster. And so what, if you can put your work out there into the world, what is something that you kind of hope to maybe change about everybody's perception about magic?
Well, I guess it's twofold. My main goal when I started Appalachian Witchery was to try to preserve Appalachian culture, at least an aspect of Appalachian culture that has kind of been pushed into the dark corners. Even people who do Appalachian studies, they don't really, at least in my experience, because I haven't read every Appalachian studies paper or book known to man, but they don't really discuss a lot of the witch folklore or the magic that they would do. And so I was very worried that it was a part that was kind of being lost in the conversation when we were talking about Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to kind of bring that to the forefront because I'm very proud of where I'm from. I'm not ashamed to say I was born in a very small town. I think we had like 2,000 people in it. And I think the county may have had 6,000 people altogether. But and then when it comes to, you know, witchcraft and magic, just that I want to kind of demystify it, because there is power in in it being kind of the secret, hidden, spooky sort of thing. But that it is something that I can sit down and craft you this spell, but you are going to be the one that I need you to actually do part of it for me, so that everyone can kind of understand that everybody has the ability. Everyone has the ability to kind of tap into these natural forces and kind of take charge of their own life in the process. Because, I mean, you know, we live in the quick fix prescription society where I have a problem, give me a pill, let's fix it. And I think that kind of correlates into the occult world, the New Age world at large. People come to healers and workers and think that we can fix them in one session. And they don't have to go home and do any work on their own. And that's sadly not the case. Because if you go and get Reiki, yeah, you're going to feel better. But when you go home, you need to take some of the things that you've learned in your session and start applying them to your life. If you're not applying them, then you're not actually doing the work. And you'll start making those decisions again and ending up in the same place. So it kind of goes back to that whole kind of idea of power of attraction. If you're not willing to make the changes, then you just keep attracting the same thing that you've been doing. And so for me, when I do the consultations or I do the readings, I really try to embed that idea that it's good that you're coming to me because you're getting an outsider's perspective. You're getting some advice, some knowledge that you wouldn't have had otherwise. But ultimately, the work lies with you in order to make those changes. I can assist you and I can help you in that, but it is mostly personal responsibility. And I guess that's really what I try to stress the most, is preservation of a culture and personal responsibility for your life.
Hmm. If someone's listening to this and realizing for the first time that they might be a witch because of our conversation, which will happen, what would you advise them to do first? Like if they feel this real flush of like, oh my God, this is amazing, this is the thing for me, like where would a new person go to kind of begin learning about this? Do you have any particular resources or books or things that you would recommend?
The first thing I would say is if you're, you know, kind of acknowledging, oh, wow, I might be a witch, is not to go running through the streets and announcing that to everyone.
Okay.
Because that, and we do that sometimes when we discover something new that we're very passionate about. We're like, oh, this is what I am. This is who I am.
Yeah.
And it's off-putting. And especially when you're, if we're talking, you know, I might be a witch, is you will encounter a lot of those people that are going to try to extinguish that light, tell you you're crazy, it doesn't work, it's just nonsense. So that's my first advice, is don't, you know, run out telling everyone what you think unless there's someone that you can really trust. And so finding those people is the next step. And there are resources like The Witch's Voice online. I think it's www.witchvox.com.
Okay.
And they have a drop-down menu on either the left or the right-hand side. I haven't been to the website in a while. And you can select your state or your country of where you're living, and then narrow it down. And people post group meetups there. They post kind of personals. I years ago, I had one on there myself, trying just to meet like-minded people to talk and discuss. Facebook is a great resource. I'm a member of a lot of groups, like Pagans of the Northeast, which is all situated for Northeast Tennessee. There's Friends of TC, which is Friends of the Tri-Cities. which is what we call the area I live in, Johnson City, Bristol. Kingsport is a tri-cities area. And then anyone who is any sort of pagan or witch can post their events, can post meetups there. So finding those people, and you can just go into like Facebook and type in San Diego witchcraft, and you're going to probably find a ton of options, groups, that sort of thing there. Books wise, I always like to start people kind of out with the basics. One being, I am a Cabot witch. I've trained with Lori Cabot, and I'm actually going for my second degree in 2 weeks with Lori Cabot.
I forgot to ask you about that. Yes. Take a second and explain what that is. Cabot tradition.
Okay. Yeah. So the Cabot tradition, is created by Lori Cabot. It's known as the Cabot Kent tradition. And Lori Cabot is just a fascinating woman. She, was one of the first to be a public witch in America, in the early 70s. And she had been initiated and trained, by some witches in Boston, I believe, back when she was, I think, 15. And they came from Kent, England. And so when she started teaching publicly, she titled her tradition the Cabot Kent tradition, because she had added some of her own flavor into things, which is always so important to me. When people are trying to teach witchcraft, I'm like, you need to have done it long enough, for one, to teach it, and two, to have your own sort of ideas and structure and tradition that you've created to teach, because witchcraft is a very personal thing. And that's something that Lori brought to it, was that she had spent all these years crafting herself as a witch and had all these years of knowledge. And so she started teaching in Salem in the mid-70s. And I think by the late 70s, Dukakis, Governor Dukakis, I think he was at the time, gave her the title of Official Witch of Salem. And since then, she has been on Oprah, a bunch of other talk shows, teaching about witchcraft and her tradition. And she, to this day, she's 85 now, and she's still teaching the classes. And being present at the rituals, the eight Sabbats that they follow, the eight high holidays for her tradition and for kind of witchcraft at large. We have eight holidays that we usually follow. Some traditions are a little different than others, and they don't, you know, do all eight, but, so, about 2 years ago, I had the availability, the time and the money to go and study, in her Witchcraft 1 class, and got my first degree, in the Cabot Kent tradition, which as, when I was 13, that is who I saw walking down the street of Salem. I was like,
oh my gosh.
And so, I studied more from the time I was 13 on, I realized who that had been, who I had seen. And I was like, I have to study with this woman. And then, you know, 20 years later, it manifested. I had put out in the universe all those years ago. And so sometimes that's how magic works. I would love magic to be, you know, like bewitched and we could wiggle our nose and it manifests on the spot. But sometimes magic takes a long time to actually manifest into your life. And so I studied with her back in 2016. And then coming up July 15th, I'm going back up to Salem for my second degree in her tradition. So, that's fascinating. A little very rough history of her that I gave you.
No, that's cool. I intended to ask you about it earlier. It was something that, because the whole tradition thing is an avenue that a lot of people explore. There are different lines of witchcraft, different types of traditions. I'm really speaking from kind of a lone practitioner, eclectic sort of person, which you also, you know, do kind of in your everyday life. But I think one of the takeaways for me, for someone, if they're new, is to... Like you said, well, good on Facebook. There are some things that Facebook does really, really well, and that could be one of them,
Yes.
is to connect with people locally. There is a lot about when I go back to my interests in these subjects and where they came from. A lot of what I learned was, physically in a certain location, or it was a certain kind of shop, like you talked about. Most cities have that cool little store where there are people working there who are resource. There are people putting flyers up for events, and it is kind of there is something about the power of where it takes place. You know what I mean? Like different parts of the world, different parts of the country
Oh,
have
definitely.
different energy, have different, because this is so connected to nature. Even though you can use the internet as a tool to kind of find some resources, if you can ground that in people where you are, I think that would be my advice based on your advice. You know what I'm
Oh
saying?
yeah. That's perfect advice. Because, like you said, the way that someone's going to connect to their place is going to be different depending on where they're at. Someone in Singapore is definitely going to have a different sort of, probably even a different definition of witchcraft and practice of witchcraft in Singapore as compared to, me sitting here in Johnson City, Tennessee. We're probably going to go about it two different ways. So yes, if you can find a local spot, then definitely, capitalize on that. Read the flyers, talk to the store owners, talk to the people that are working there, because they're going. Because I did as well work at a sort of a metaphysical shop for about 8 years when I moved down here to Johnson City, and people definitely talk to the shop workers about what they're doing, what they're looking for. Any sort of meetup or ritual gathering that's going on. And so they are a plethora of information. But you have to talk to them. You have to ask them.
They're like metaphysical librarians. But you're right. A lot of the people who work in those stores are not just retail employees. They're there because they have knowledge about herbalism or knowledge about crystals, or like they're specifically involved in the community in something like a local circle or coven or something like that. That's where you'll find them if you want to meet them. And they're often identified by their jewelry.
We witches love our very large pieces of jewelry.
Statement necklaces. Well, and listen, I know it's always a it kind of puts you on the spot a little bit when somebody asks you to like recommend books or something in the middle of a conversation. So I'm thinking after we have this conversation, you're probably going to think of things like, oh, I should have mentioned this book or this website or whatever. So you can send those to me if they come to you and you think of something you want me to put in the show notes, because I'll put all the stuff that we've talked about in the show notes and link to different books and sites and stuff. So if you want to add to that, we'll have some time here from the time we record until it goes out. So I'll be working on that, and you can. It's also interesting that you'll be going on your trip to study with Lori again, probably around the same time that everyone is listening to this. Yeah, that same week. So yeah, so there's going to be a lot of energy behind you. A lot of people are going to be thinking about you and what you're doing up there. And then when you get back, they're probably going to want to, contact you. It's been really fantastic capturing this conversation with you. I feel like I'm kind of running long on time, and we'll have to have you come back at some point and go down some specific rabbit holes, 'cause this is you're the first witch to be on this show, and given the fact that I identify with that word as well, it's kind of like, dang, why haven't I talked about this? So you're representing for a big canopy of topics here, and I appreciate what a good job that you did in making it like kind of specific and unique to you and your practice, but also introducing the topic at large to a lot of different people. This is a big, big topic. There used to be statistics out there about neo-paganism and sort of the growth of that spiritual tradition statistically, in this country. And there's a lot of people interested in this and wanting to learn more about it. So tell everyone the best place they can go to find you online. What's your Facebook page?
The best place is going to be my Facebook page. It is just titled Appalachian Witchery. And there is a picture of the Blue Ridge Mountains, so the mountains are going to look kind of blue. And it's going to say Appalachian Witchery in red font. I used to have a website, but there's a whole other story about that that I'm not going to get into because it was canceled by the people that owned Square.
Oh, interesting.
There's a whole, I don't know, there's a whole thing about occult businesses and how they don't support that, and they canceled my
Oh,
website basically.
wow.
That, like, that's basically the story. I made them quite a bit of money. And
Wow.
then they decided to delete me and a bunch of other people based on the content of our website, which was really just me selling my crafts and my classes. Like, you could go and
Gosh,
buy your
yeah.
seat to my class on that website, which made it so much easier for me. Because I could say, I can seat 30 people and put 30 tickets up on the website, and then they would sell, and I wouldn't have to worry about trying to send out emails letting people know that I had gotten their money and that their seat had been saved, which is what I've had to go back to at this point, sort of
Well,
thing.
everybody
So,
can
yeah.
definitely see what you're doing on your Facebook page because I saw, where you'd posted some stuff talking about your upcoming class that you were going to do with Lori. And so, I mean, it can do all the it can do a lot of things
It
for you,
can.
and it's good enough for people to go and check out what you do. And like you said, you have your number there, so they can email you or call you and set up a consultation. And of course, I'll link to it, so it'll be easy to find. But this was really great, Ian. I've wanted to talk to you for a while. I've enjoyed following you on Facebook for so many reasons, and I really want to thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thank you for, inviting me. I've enjoyed being able to talk about my practice and things. And so, yeah, definitely, I'm very much interested in coming back and talking more about things, because I'm not just a solitary practitioner. I actually have a group here in the mountains, and we've kind of crafted our own tradition here that I would love to, talk about
Okay,
sometime
cool.
about what we do and how we've kind of crafted this tradition.
Yeah, maybe we can time it with one of the holidays or something and put some intention around some of those traditional witch points in the year, you know what I mean? Like
Oh, yeah.
that would be really cool to do some content around some of those. Or maybe we'll have you come back for Halloween since that's your
Oh, yeah.
favorite. We'll do some stuff around
The
that.
witch's busiest month,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
October. Yeah,
Yeah, that would be
that.
great.
Yeah, definitely. I very much look forward to it.
Thanks again for listening to the Shift Your Spirits podcast. For show notes, links, transcripts, and all the past episodes, please visit shiftyourspirits.com. You can subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or whatever app you use to access podcasts. If you'd like to get an intuitive reading with me or download a free ebook and meditation to help you connect with your guides, please go to sladeroberson.com. And if you're interested in my professional intuitive training program, you can start the course for free by downloading the attunement at automaticintuition.com. Before I go, I promise to leave you a message, an answer to a question or a concern you may have. So take a moment to think about that. Hold it in your mind or speak it out loud. I'll pause for just a few seconds right now. It's time to take a hard look at where you're giving away your power. Where you're blaming other people, procrastinating, avoiding what you know needs to be done, and just hoping it will all go away or someone else will do it for you. Think of this as the time for the utmost maturity, adulting at the highest level you can manage. taking responsibility for your well-being and the experiences you're creating. It's time to change what you can and deal with what you can't. Get clear about which is which and adjust accordingly. The Serenity Prayer is your mantra. Use it, and I'll talk to you later.